Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, episode 38, all about projection screens. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off the lifetime of your new account, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code HTG. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. This week's guest geek is Don Stewart, owner and partner at Stewart Film Screen. Hey, Don, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Scott. Appreciate your having me do the show.
Yeah, well, I sure do appreciate it, and I'm looking forward to talking with you about projection screens. Before I get to that, though, I want to just make a quick note that those who are tuned in to the live video stream at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Don, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So, Don, I wanted to start with a little bit of the history of Stewart Film Screen, which has been in existence for over 60 years, and I believe been in your family the whole time. You are, what, the second or third generation Stewart to be at the helm there?
Well, actually, I'm the third generation. My grandfather started it back in the late 40s, and he was an acquaintance of Walt Disney. Walt Disney was one of our first customers and get us going. And even today, it's the largest customer that we have. Mm. So my father and my uncles got involved in the 50s. And then I've been here since 1980. And this is my 30th anniversary last month.
No kidding. Wow. Congratulations. There we're seeing a picture of the entrance to the main building there. These are photos, by the way, that I took during one of my tours of Stewart Film Screen, which I found fascinating. The campus is in Torrance, and it seems to have grown organically over time. I remember hearing a story about that started in one little building that's actually still on the property, and it has just continued to expand since then, right?
Yeah, it started the original building on Sepulveda Boulevard in Torrance. And now we're over 5 acres, somewhere in the neighborhood of about 20 buildings. We annexed a small portion of land at it each time and then put up a building on it as we grew. Basically, we always kind of laugh and say it's a garage business that got out of hand.
I think we have a picture called Stewart Warren. That if we put that up, there it is. I took this picture. Your whole campus reminds me of a bit like a rabbit warren in that there are these tunnels and passageways between buildings and so on that that just are quite remarkable in their organic quality of just having seem to have sprouted from almost nothing.
Right. It's actually what we do here is we make all the screen materials from scratch. So there's a lot. It kind of looks like a refinery. There's pipes and compressors and environmental equipment. So it's very industrial looking when you walk through some of these buildings.
Right. Exactly. I got another couple of pictures, one of a bunch of rolls of screen material, which John might be able to put up there. And it is fascinating that you make the material from scratch right there. There's a picture of many rolls of material. You make all kinds of different material there, but most of it, I believe, is based on some form of plastic or I don't know exactly what the material is.
We manufacture with a base of polyvinyl chloride or PVC, and then there's additional diffusers and optical coatings that go in that. We use a spray cast method, which you saw. We wouldn't allow you to take photos of it, but they're right. 40 by 90 foot molds, so we can make large venue screens up to 40 by 90 foot, completely seamless one-piece construction, either front or rear projection.
Yeah, yeah, it's remarkable, actually. I was also interested in some of the more esoteric applications, such as projecting onto glass spheres. And I know we have a picture of that as well.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I had some fun taking photos of those spheres. but I was amazed at a projection, say, of the Earth onto the inner surface of that glass sphere and how realistic it looked. It was amazing.
Yeah, we have one client that does acrylic domes, and they sent us the domes up to 6 feet in diameter, and we put the optical coating on the inside. They take a DLP projector with a fisheye lens and project up from the bottom of these globes, and you can project the complete globe of the Earth, and it's great for education or museums. You can see where ocean currents are warming or hurricanes. In fact, I think we're sending 1,000 of these smaller ones to China for their school. Our client is an integrator, and they put together the projection system, the lens, the software, and of course the screen, and send them all over the world. But quite a few of these are going to the schools in China right now.
That's incredible. And I guess you'd have to be pretty careful in calculating the amount of fisheye in the lens and so on to match the size of the globe in order to get the proportions right and to get everything where it needs to be on that spherical surface.
Correct. And the lenses are all, of course, custom made for the individual sizes.
Right. Right. Exactly. Well, let's talk a little bit about the basics of screen technology and terminology, because I know that there's a lot of confusion out there about it. We have front projection, of course, which seems reasonably straightforward. You project an image onto the front of a screen and it reflects back into the audience. This is what happens in movie theaters. And then we have rear projection, which used to be rear projection TVs. Did Stuart make screens for rear projection TVs?
We made them on a small quantity, but the consumer products, the Hitachis, the Mitsubishis, the Toshiba, and the Panasonics, were generally made through a compression molding, and it was a hard type screen with a Fresnel lens on the back and a lenticular front. And they did this because the CRTs were relatively low in lumen output, and they had a very short focal length lens. So the Fresnel on the back would collimate the light before it enters the diffusion surface. And
what do you mean by collimate?
Collimate is that if you have a short lens behind a rear projection screen, the light out in the corners and on the sides are hitting at an extreme angle. They're not hitting the back of the acrylic plane perpendicular.
Oh, yeah.
So the Fresnel lens would had a groove kind of like the back of an LP record, and each groove had a different pitch, and its first job was to turn the light of the incident light coming from the projector and turn it so it enters the back of the screen perpendicular.
Ah, yes.
And then the lenticulated front, which kind of looked like corduroy material, would disperse the light horizontally across the room. And if you recall on the old rear projection sets, that if you stood up or sat down, if you stood up, the brightness would normally go down, and the light would be pretty much designed for sitting on a couch. And so it created actually a hot band going across from left to right in the center of it. Most of those screens were 4 or 5 gain, and they had to be high gain and overcome the ambient light typically found in a living room. Those screens pretty much have disappeared, the lenticular Fresnel types, with the digital projectors, because now lumens are cheap and we can go back to diffusion technology.
You mentioned gain, and I wanted to get into that a little bit, because that is an area of great confusion, I believe. screen with gain, say 1.3, or you mentioned 2 or 3, or they can be as high as 5 or 10 or more in 3D screens, it seems to imply that you get more light coming off of the screen than you put into it. But that can't be true, can it?
Well, as you know, a screen is a passive device, and it can't make energy. But where a screen maker can make a screen smart is that we can reflect, in the case of a front projection screen, the energy back in a specific zone. So typically a one-gain screen, what we calibrate is off of a lab standard called magnesium carbonate. And basically it's like a chunk of white chalk, very mattish, would be very close. And it's almost a perfect Lambertian diffuser.
And a Lambertian diffuser, let's make sure everyone understands, is a reflective surface that reflects light in all directions equally, right?
That is correct. And on the same token, though, it accepts light from any angle and will reflect it back equally, too.
Yes, I see. Whereas a screen, particularly a screen with some gain to it, more than one, what we sometimes call unity gain, will reflect light coming into it, onto it, reflect it back only in certain, more in certain directions than in other directions, correct?
Correct. And that's a good screen is designed with an engineered surface. So therefore, we want to put the brightness back where the audience is sitting and not have it splashing up against the walls and ceilings where no one's sitting and wasting it. And second to that, if we have light splashing out to the walls and to the ceiling, that same light's going to reflect off those walls and come back and wash out our black level.
Mm-hmm.
So the gain helps you in two ways. It increases the foot lamberts or brightness and also increases your dynamic range by having less light come back and wash because it's going to go back to where the audience is sitting and not to the close walls if it's designed properly.
Right. Now, if it's not designed properly, when you focus the light coming back from the screen onto the audience, you might get what are called hot spots. That is, areas of the screen that are brighter than other areas of the screen. And you do want the whole surface of the screen to be relatively uniform in brightness, at least when viewed from the seating position, right?
Correct. And that's the white field uniformity. The higher the gain the screen is, what you want is the lens to be longer or the projector to be set back further because then again, the light will be more perpendicular to the screen as it hits the corners and the sides and the top and the bottom if the projector is further back. If you use a short focal length lens with a gain screen, you're going to have the proverbial hotspot.
We're already getting some questions from the chat room and some really good ones too. Here's one that I get often, and I'd love to hear your take on it. Why do I need a screen at all? Why can't I just project onto a white wall?
Well, you could project onto a white wall, and if you go down to Home Depot and buy a matte white or flat white screen, 000 white, and paint the wall and sand it, and paint the wall and sand it, you could get pretty close to that magnesium carbonate or that Lambertian diffuser we were talking about. If that is going to be your choice, then you do want to control the room as far as the walls and the ceilings of being very, very dark like a cave, because that light from that white wall is going to reflect equally in all directions.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you built yourself a bat cave, and you have pretty close to a matte white screen.
Right, exactly. Stuart makes a screen called the Studio Tech 100. And I believe there's another version of it, the Ultramat 100 or Snowmat 100?
Snowmat 100 has been around for a while, and we use that in a lot of lab environments and viewing rooms out at the studios.
Right.
It's a completely neutral screen.
Right. A Lambertian reflector, as you were mentioning, where that reflects light in all directions, very inert in terms of its imaging. And so you really need a really dark room, a black hole, essentially, for it to work well. And similar to what you're saying here with the white paint, if you do that correctly, you're going to need a bat cave, as you say, or a black hole, as I often call it, for that to work well.
Right. And the Snowmat Studio Tech 100 is designed for professional projection environments. We, in the home theater environment, call it Studio Tech 100. It's pretty much interchangeable product. We release it on the market very, very conservatively because if it is not used in the right context, I think people would be unhappy. If you have a video file who has designed a room for professional projection, have plenty of lumens to light it up with, it's an excellent product. It would be like if we were comparing it with speakers in the audio world, the Studio Tech 100 combination Snowmat is a studio monitor, so to speak. What's coming out of that projector is what you get. It's perfectly flat. But like in the speaker world, most speakers will enhance the audio with their color, the warmth, or whatever the listener likes. So most of the screens that we sell commercially are image enhancing, and they will do things depending on which model material is to enhance the image or to help under adverse room conditions.
Right, which was my next question, actually. I wanted to get to talking about white versus gray versus even black screens. We've seen, you know, in the marketplace, there are a few screens that are actually black in color. And you make a couple of gray screens, the Greyhawk and the Firehawk. And I just wanted you to talk a bit about the difference between them and where would you use them?
Okay, well, first of all, there's really no such thing technically as a black screen. They're dark charcoal, but or dark. They're really in the dark gray screen, literally. They do look fairly black, but
they're not technically black. I understand.
Yeah. The gray screens have been made for 60 years in the rear projection world because, as you remember, going back to the rear projection boxes you're talking about, you've noticed that the screens were a neutral density gray. Front projection screens traditionally have been white or silver. In the old, in the 20s and 30s, we still refer to silver screen when we talk about commercial theaters, or the reviewers are talking about a movie for commercial release. Back in the 1970s, we made our first gray screen, and it was to correct a problem that we had. Disney makes a format called Circle Vision, and if you've been to the parks or even Epcot Park, you might have gone into these large theaters that have circular projection, and it's 11 flat segmented screens that are orientated around the room. So when we manufactured a small scale down Circle Vision for Disney for out on their soundstage so they could do the dubbing and editing, they were white screens, and they were matte white. And the reason why they were matte white is they have maybe 300 people entering this theater at a time, and you may be looking up at screen number one, which is right above your head, and looking across the theater to screen number nine. So they had to have the same light uniformity no matter which screen you're looking at time. So the matte came into that. We put up all white screens. And when they lit up with the projectors the first time, the white was reflecting and cross-reflecting to the adjacent screens and the screens on the opposite side of the theater. It looked like we opened up the inside of your refrigerator. It was just all white. Working with the Disney people, we designed a 0.4, relatively low gain, very dark gray matte screen. That solved the problem. Disney had to go back and put bigger lamps in their projectors, but for Disney, that's not a problem. They have the budget, and they have something called the bigger hammer theory. Just make it bigger or make it stronger when they have a problem. And so it worked, and it worked well. And we've been manufacturing those for Disney for years and years. And then in the early 1980s, CRT projectors started becoming prevalent. And then the prosumer ones ended out started showing up in homes and residents. And at 0.4 gain, the last thing we were going to do is put a 0.4 gain with a CRT projector, which had a hard enough time getting enough light on a 1.5 gain screen, for instance. So it basically, nothing happened with gray screens. Kind of a funny story in, I guess it was 1999, I went on AB Science, which, you know, is a web where, not a chat room, but a bulletin board type.
Yeah, forum.
And, I was going through the screen section, and there was a guy who was, a lot of the guys back then, there were less than 6,000 members at that time. It was a very small group. And there was a guy that was putting in a theater in his home, and He was he had a Sony VPL HT10. If you recall that projector, which it was a pretty nice little LCD projector for the time, and he was couldn't decide on how big of an image he wanted, so he was projecting on the wall, and he would sit down and watch a movie at one image width, and then he would zoom it in or zoom it out and watch at another image width, and he finally decided on the image size that he wanted. Now, the unique thing is he had kind of navy gray walls in the house. And so he purchases an electric screen, and it happened to be matte white. And he turns the projector on, and he lowers the screen, and the screen comes down halfway, so he gets, by default, an A-B comparison between the matte white screen and the gray wall.
Very smart. And,
well, he didn't mean to. He was watching
it
roll down. It was an accident. And he comes on the forum. He goes, "My God, the gray wall looks so much better. My blacks are deeper. And I can see shadow detailing and on the gray wall." And so he was very disappointed in the $1,500 he spent for this electric screen. the light kicked off in my head that night. Next morning I came in and we took some of the Disney gray material, and actually we made 0.4, and we had another version that was 0.7. And we took the gray matte material and put it back into the spray booth to get a sample of it. Just taped up a small piece, and we coated it with a Studio Tech 130 optical coating over the gray base. And voila, we had a from a 0.7, it went up to 0.92, and that was the prototype for the gray mat. And within, I think 60 days, we released it on the market. We did some beta testing market with some of the folks on AV Science, and had an extremely successful product that within 6 months was one of our best-selling screens.
That's incredible.
This guy, poor guy on AV Forum, doesn't realize probably to this day that by putting up that post, it sparked the little light to go off in my head. And then you look at Stuart with his gray screens, and then there dozen other manufacturers in the world that make front projection gray screens. So it's probably of so close to $1 billion since then over the last 10 years, and you combine all the screen sales together. And it all started with this guy's little thing on the forum.
That's incredible. A couple questions come to mind from that story. One is, when you have a gain of less than one, you were mentioning a 0.4 for Disney, 0.7, up to 0.9. What does that mean? Does that mean that the screen is absorbing some of the light and simply not sending it back into the room?
Well, if it's a 0.4 screen, yes, it's absorbing it. It's not as efficient, but it is absorbing the light. Now, one of the things that people say, it's a negative gain screen, and in that case, it is, if it's a matte screen. Let's go back to the Greyhawk we were just talking about. Our gray base, when it was still in the mat before we put the final optical coating, was a 0.7. Mm-hmm. Then we put the optical coating on it and became a 0.92. Actually, that is still a gain screen because it is still somewhat directional. In other words, the 0.92 gain was in the suite seats where the audience was sitting. But if you would go over to the side of the theater off 80 degrees, we're putting out about 0.4, 0.5 gain. So it was, even though it's less than one, or what some refer to as a negative gain screen, it still acts like a gain screen, and that is somewhat directional.
And that's because of the optical coating, right? And that's another question I wanted to ask you about. What is this optical coating?
Well, the optical coating are the final coatings that are put on the screen that have different rare earths, depending on who the manufacturer is, that will actually reflect the light back in a controlled manner. And during the manufacturing process, depending on how we formulate it, we'll determine what the half gain, and half gain is the angle off of being perpendicular or center degrees, 0 degrees center, to where it hits its half luminance, or 1 foot, in other words, be half the foot Lambert's of what you're seeing at the hottest spot, which would be at 0 degrees.
Right, exactly. So you're at 0 degrees, you see the most light, and you move off axis some number of degrees until you see half that amount of light. That's your half gain angle.
Correct. And of course, the higher the gain the screen is, the more narrow the half gain, because as you said earlier, screens can't make energy, or we both said that.
Yeah.
So if we make it brighter in the sweet seat, we got to take the energy from somewhere, so that will become much narrower. If you recall the old Klaus units that had the parabolic curved screens.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the 80s, the silver curved ones. Those were like some of those in the beginning were 10, 12 gain, and the half gain was maybe 6 to 7 degrees either side of center. As you could actually see that if you were in the sweet seat, it would look nice and bright, and you move over 3 feet, and it would start going dark on you.
Right, exactly. I wanted to ask you a little bit about screen size versus light output. Now, projector companies all specify the light output of their projectors as so many ANSI lumens, which is one measure of brightness. And of course, as you get a larger and larger screen, that amount of light has to spread over a greater and greater distance, which decreases your peak white, the most amount of light that you're going to be able to see off that screen. Do projector light output specs have any meaning at all? Is that something that the consumers can look at or not?
You're going to get me in trouble here.
Yeah.
You know, we measure lumens or projector coming, the light coming out of a projector, we measure in lumens, which is the horsepower. Mm-hmm. As soon as the light hits a screen, either front or rear projection, we call it foot Lamberts. And basically,
it's a different means of measuring amount of light.
Right. And foot Lamberts is exactly what it says. One square foot, Lambert meaning light. So
actually, it's named after a guy named Lambert, right? Who did a lot of early research.
Right, the more square foot the screen is, obviously, the thinner the light's going to go on it. Same thing with the rear projection screen. If you have 15-foot Lamberts coming off of a one-gain front projection screen, it works just the same on a rear projection screen. You'd have 15-foot Lamberts being transmitted, so to speak, through the screen.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go to lumens, it's very simple to figure out or predict how bright your screen is going to be in the design phase. You simply take the square footage of the screen, and let's say it's a 54-inch by 96, which is 110-inch diagonal. It's 36 square feet. And if we had 1,000 lumens out of the projector, you divided the 1,000 lumens divided by the 36 square feet in the screen, and I don't have my calculator, but I think that's about 27 foot Lamberts. Now, if the screen had gain, let's say it was 1.3 gain, then you take the 27 foot Lamberts, that's with a Lambertian diffuser, times 1.3 or whatever the gain of it, and that would bring it up to about 36 foot Lamberts with a 1.3 gain. So it's an easy formula. But the gotcha in this thing is that if you take the 1,000 or whatever lumens that the projector manufacturer has and completely base it on that spec, you're probably going to be disappointed. Typically, when I give classes on this, I tell people 60%, use 60% of what the projector manufacturer is saying. And even at worst, it might be a little bit brighter than what you expected, but you don't get too many complaints in that area.
Right.
Just run the projector a while and let the lamp run down some.
Yeah, we know that lamps are going to drop in their light output from their initial value and then stabilize for maybe 1,000 hours or so. Some people say as little as 500. But generally speaking, you're going to you need to take the manufacturer's spec with a grain of salt. And in fact, when you're doing your calculations, make it only about 60% of what they say, because I'm sure they play the same similar kinds of games as amp manufacturers, for example, who say, we can do 1,000 watts. Well,
like RMS,
yeah, exactly. So, great. Well, we've got some more questions from the chat room, but before we get to them, and I will get to them, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. It's got an easy-to-use user interface for creating and managing websites and blogs. It's optimized for both beginners and experts. And there are hundreds of design templates to choose from, so you can customize any of your designs to fit your needs. This all-inclusive service has different modules to build your website, a blog module, forum, form builders for collecting email addresses, Flickr photo displays, Twitter widgets, and this thing's got everything. Google Maps. It's got website tracking and built-in search engine optimizer, which is certainly something you would want if you're building a website for other people to find. And permission access handling, cloud architecture for speed and site stability, and an innovative drag-and-drop Ajax interface. It's even got an iPhone app, so you can log on to your website and update it wherever you are. Use Squarespace for all your website needs to build, host, and update at any time. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com and sign up for a free account. No credit card needed. Just try it out to build your own website. Then, if you decide to buy, use the offer code HTG and get 10% off the lifetime of your new account. That's squarespace.com and use the offer code HTG. So, Don, we're back with you now, and we got a couple of questions in the chat room about acoustically transparent screens. And these, of course, have anticipated my question on that very topic, because there are several ways to do it. You can perforate the screen with tiny little holes, and I think we have a picture of that. There it is. Might be hard to see for those who are watching the video. And let's start with that, because that's the technique that you use for creating an acoustically transparent screen. On that picture, we saw two different types of perforation. On the bottom, we see little tiny holes, and on the top, we see even tinier holes that are spaced much more closely together. Can you tell us about those?
Cinema perf, and that's the design used for large venue screens. Again, if we were doing a 90-foot screen, we'd be using the larger perforations.
That's called cinema perf.
Right.
And that's what you find in every commercial cinema.
Everyone I've been in, and there's been a lot of them, the perforation holes will vary from manufacturer to manufacturer as far as size. But the those holes are designed to be used with a loudspeaker with a high frequency horn, not tweeters on it. Mm. And back in the late 80s, when home cinema was getting a pretty good, making good ground, people started to use perforated screens, and we were using the cinema perf. And that perforation will pretty much disappear past 16 feet in a commercial cinema. But in most home environments, you're sitting at 16 feet or closer.
What do you mean it'll disappear at 16 feet or farther?
In a commercial theater, if you sit in the front one or two rows, you're going to see the perforations under high-keyed seats. So at 16 feet, and if you're at 16-foot Lamberts or under, those holes will be hard to see in a commercial theater.
Right.
Ask the average person on the street and tell them there's, you know, billions of holes in the movie theater screen they just went to, and most people wouldn't even realize that, sure. The average person.
Right.
But in the late 80s, we started looking at home cinema as far as dedicated rooms were getting more serious and people wanted to create the commercial theater environment. We designed a microperf machine, which has holes that are 24 thousandths of an inch in diameter, 30,000 holes per square foot, and we lose about 10.2% of the surface. And with the CRTs, since they were lower in foot Lamberts, that would disappear about 6 or 7 feet. With today's projectors, being a little bit brighter, you have your perceived resolution is higher the brighter it is. So they disappear about 10 to 12 feet, depending on how bright the projector is.
Mm-hmm. But still, putting speakers behind a screen, a perforated screen, it has its own set of challenges, does it not?
Well, certainly. The screen itself is going to take away some of the high frequency, and in most applications, you're going to put some type of EQ to adjust for that. You go to most of the post-production facilities in Hollywood here use a Michael Per screen or similar, and they're actually doing their mixing under the same environment. So the your good post-production facilities will have the center, left, and right behind the screen. So they're getting the same effect there.
So you need some EQ to maybe boost up the high end a little bit because you're losing it as it's going through the screen?
Yes, you can lose a dB and a half or up to 2 dB up at the high end, the very high end. In fact, interesting, when we would rescreen a room, take out the old screen and put a new screen in, they would go back and re-EQ for that screen because the new screen may have a different frequency response than even though it was the same perforation pattern as the older screen. Because the older screen is cured out. It's not as flexible as it dries out if it's 15, 20 years old. And it always go through re-EQing on a brand new screen. And have to make some fine-tuning adjustments.
And am I not also correct that you need to put the speakers back away from the back surface of the screen a bit?
Well, when we were working with THX, getting the THX certification back in the 90s on the MicroPerf, they found that the 8 to 12 inches was seemed to be the sweet spot on speakers. Though when you do push them up within a couple inches, there is a little bit more high frequency loss, but it's I couldn't hear the difference, but I guess the guys was golden ears could.
We got a question, several questions in the chat room regarding perforation and MicroPerf screens. One of them is, as the resolution of digital projectors got higher, it went from 480 to 720 to 1080. Were we starting to see problems with moiré, with an interference between these tiny little holes and the tiny little pixels?
Actually, it worked the opposite. The original digital devices had more moiré problems than the higher resolution ones because the pixels kept getting smaller and smaller. And so the mathematical equation, which is very, very long, to figure it out actually got better.
And yet you also, am I not mistaken, decided to rotate or put these MicroPerfs at an angle, at a bias, if you will, rather than rectilinear, straight up and down and back and forth.
Yeah, we started doing that back in, I think it was the late 90s or right around the turn of the century there. And so it's basically changing the perforation pattern or the alignment to the pixelization pattern.
And wasn't that in order to minimize moiré problems?
Correct.
Another question about perf screens is, will they work with polarized 3D screens?
Curved screens?
No, polarized 3D screens. Polarization preserving 3D screens, metal screens.
Okay, you mean as far as the perforations?
Correct. Oh, yeah. Yes.
We currently perforate most of our large silver screens for large venues. At this time, we do not like to perforate our silver screens with the MicroPerf because it does have a metalized finish on the front, and it's very hard on all those thousands of pins on the MicroPerf. But we're actually going through some reformulation now in order to accommodate small MicroPerf silver screens.
Well, that brings me to my next question, which is also in the chat room about 3D. And the need for silver screens in the case of polarized 3D. Now, there are several different ways to create a 3D image on a front projection system. One of them is by polarizing the light differently for the left and right eye. And for that, you need a special screen, a silver screen, which I'm sure Stuart makes.
Correct. Polar or 3D is basically in three categories. Obviously, number one, active, which will work on any screen. The other would be a color system like Infotech and Dolby and the Dolby 3D. And then the last is a passive 3D. For instance, Real D uses a passive polarized. And that requires a silver screen which has a metallized finish. And the reason that it's required is that polarization on a standard widescreen will get diffused as it hits the screen and come back to the viewer unpolarized, and it basically there's no effect on the when you're wearing the glasses.
Right.
So silver screens generally run about 2.5 to 3.5, 4 gain, depending on what the customer is looking for.
Mm-hmm.
They carry some baggage with them in the sense that the hotspot you were talking about, because it is a high gain screen, and the half gains run in the neighborhood of about 24 to 28 degrees. So they're going to have an narrower half gain than a standard screen.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they're very fragile, difficult to clean, and they don't ship well because they are fragile.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a salesman for Stuart, as you can see. I'm looking at it from the
technical all right.
The technical, they carry some problems. But at this point, passive 3D, especially commercially, they do prefer polarized because they can make the glasses and their throwaway glasses that you can keep. When you have a the active glasses or even the Dolby glasses, they have to be sterilized to be reused. So they have public health issues. So the silver screens seem to still prevail.
Yeah, and I was very impressed at Cedia, where we were last month, to see a Stuart product called the Daily Dual, I believe, which is a fixed silver 3D polarization preserving screen, and then a drop down white screen that goes down in front of it. Because the problem I see is that the 3D screen, the silverized polarization preserving screen, is fine for 3D. In fact, for passive 3D, polarized 3D, it's essential, but it's not that great for projecting 2D.
That's correct. And the reason is the issues of white field uniformity become a problem. It almost sometimes could be too bright if you have a 3.5 gain screen for a dark room environment anyway. And so most video files are even close to being video files are not going to live with the baggage that comes with them.
Mm-hmm. I forgot to ask you a question about perforations earlier, and I want to make sure I get to that. Stuart doesn't do anything with woven screen materials, correct? Because that's the other way to make a acoustically transparent screen.
No, we've shied away from woven screens. The front projection screens and rear projection screens are application driven. In other words, we make so many different models and different games and different colors. We don't make a good, better, best. It's just one screen for one room, maybe a wrong coating and wrong color for the next room. So using the perforation method, which we do in-house, allows us to be able to perforate any model front projection screen that we make, with the exception of the microperf on the silver, which we're working on.
Mm-hmm.
In the woven screen world, you're dealing with a textile product that has less than one gain to start with, quite a bit less. So you only have one AT screen or acoustical transparent surface available, and that doesn't fit within the philosophy of what we do here at Stuart. We want to match the right screen material with the right room and the right equipment and the right seating plan. So it just doesn't work within our model.
Mm. Without getting snarky or anything, what do you see as the pros and cons of perforation versus woven, just in theoretical terms?
Well, the woven screens, you probably could sit a little bit closer, although I can see some of the weaves in it when I'm sitting fairly close. And another problem I'm seeing with the woven screens is that they need a dark, very dark area behind the screen. In fact, some of the manufacturers recommend a black cloth material behind the woven screen. Then when you put the speakers behind the black cloth woven material, now you're putting two materials in front of the speaker, And some of the advantages of the acoustics of it are lost when it has to go through two materials.
Sure.
In other words, you don't lose the dB on one material and the dB on the other material. I've been told by the experts that whatever the loss on one material, then you add the other material, it squares itself.
Mm. Oh, so it's not a doubling, it's a squaring.
Yeah. Wow. That's what I've been told. I'm not an acoustic expert, but I've been told that.
Understood. I have heard also, though, that you can place speakers closer to a woven screen without as much fall off in the high end than you can behind a perf screen.
That I don't know. That
yeah.
I,
Well, we've got another question from the chat room. My friend Ray is asking about star glass. Now, this is a rear projection material that, in fact, I think you're sitting in front of right now.
Yeah, I'm at the corporate boardroom in Stuart right now, and they're playing with a piece of star glass. This is our video conferencing room here, and star glass is a unique next generation rear projection screen. It's designed; it is made out of glass, and then the layer of diffusion is actually sandwiched between two pieces of glass, and so therefore it's completely protected. And you can go up and bang on the screen or try to scratch it or whatever and not hurt it. It also meets building codes commercially in that if it acts just like safety glass in the windshield of your car. If it was broken or something damaged it, it will hold together. So in commercial applications, a lot of times they like to bring the screen down almost to the floor. In the past, we couldn't do that without tempering the glass. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in violation of local building codes.
Mm. And so this is intended for rear projection applications where you've got a projector behind it projecting onto the screen. And essentially, it looks like a flat panel TV in the wall, just gigantic.
Yes, yes. And specifically designed with commercial applications in mind, but we are putting quite a bit of it into home cinemas.
Mm-hmm. And outdoors even.
Yeah, it can go outdoors or in some cases in Florida, they designed pole houses with a star glass that will face the swimming pool. And so I guess you can watch the game while you're in the pool. And then if you're in the pool house playing pool or doing recreation, they have an electric screen that rolls down in front of the star glass, and then they have to switch the projector over to front projections, and so they can get double duty out of one projector.
Oh, that's how you do that. I got a question once from a reader who asked, is there a material that would work for both front projection and rear projection, the same material? And I said I didn't think so.
Oh, there is. That's a separate material.
Ah.
It's a front projection, rear projection screen, but quite frankly, it doesn't do either of them very well. So it's like trying to make a race car into a luxury car. Well, you can kind of do it, but it's not going to be doing either of them as well as one that's dedicated to do it.
Jack of all trades, master of none, yeah. I suppose.
Right, right.
Yeah, understood. Now, you mentioned earlier, you brought up the Nova Beam, I think it was, with the curved screen with a gain of 10. and that brings me to the question about curved screens. Now, I know that Stuart makes a curved platform called CineCurve. And I think we actually have a picture of one being manufactured. And I wanted to ask you about that and why. There it is. In your workshop, actually, being a curved frame being made. And I want to just ask you to describe that a little bit and why did you do that?
Well, we've been working with the studios and the high-end cinemas for years and years and years and years. And then, you go to the Academy Theater or the Directors Guild, any of the professional large theaters, they usually have a gentle curve in the screen. There are like four or five technical reasons I can give you. And one is that with the anamorphic lenses, there would be some pin cushioning with it on a flat screen. So,
okay, this is an optical distortion that occurs when you have a lens that widens the picture out to, it's usually used for 2.35:1 aspect ratio movies, which many are. And so you need to use this as stretching, widening lens, which does cause some optical distortions at the end, at the edges. I just want to make sure everybody understood that.
Okay, so by curving the slight curve in the screen, we almost eliminate that. And then the other is your viewing angles on a scope screen is, if you're sitting in the right front corner, right, and you're looking over to the opposite side of the auditorium or the theater, it's going to lessen the viewing angles for that particular viewer by doing the gentle curve. In a sense, if you have a standard 1.78 lens and you're at a certain throw distance, as soon as that anamorphic lens comes in front of it, you have basically shortened the throw distance when it goes out to the corners. So whatever the ratio, let's say you were at 1.6 times image width as far as the throw distance, as an example, on the 1.78:1. As soon as you go out to 2.35, that ratio of throw distance to screen width is shortened. Therefore, the curvature of the screen will also allow that gain, so to speak, to be under control without having the hot spot. Just like the 12-gain screens that were with the Class, they were curved and parabolic in both directions, or a compound curve. That's how they eliminated the hot spot on a 12-gain screen. They had to curve it. There was a reason for doing that. Another issue is that chances are the curved screen's getting very close to the left and right walls in your room now. And by angling the screen back towards the audience, we're going to have less light spill onto the walls.
Good point.
And another reason is that it's a little bit more immersive, but some of our dealers and integrators just say, hey, I don't care why, I just think the thing looks sexy, it looks good. So that's
understood.
You won't find that in our literature, but I've been told that a few times.
Yeah, right.
And again, these cine curbs are going into the dedicated, what I would call trophy rooms or the high-end rooms that people are trying to duplicate the commercial experience or the best theaters. And so we are pretty much going with the duplication of these high-end commercial theaters again.
Right, exactly. Now, you wouldn't use a CineCurve screen on a 1.78 aspect ratio. You'd use it on a 2.35:1, right?
We've had requests, and we've done a few just because they like the look of it. But from a technical standpoint, we couldn't have a reason to justify that, no.
Do you see, Ray in the chat room is asking, do you see a move towards more 2.35:1 screens in home theaters as opposed to 1.78?
For the market at Stewart, it's very, very big because we do specialize into the higher end of the demographics of the buyer. And that particular buyer is interested in the latest and greatest. And so as far as Stewart's concerned, yes, it's grown even in this market since October 2008. We continue to see growth in the CineCurve market. We're seeing these things get larger and larger and larger in the home markets. And I think we got one order the other day that caught everybody's attention. It was like 34 feet wide.
Wow. Well, you got to have a light cannon to fill a screen that big, huh?
Yeah, I think they do.
Well, if they're ordering a screen that big, they must have a projector that'll fill it.
Yeah. Now, some of these I know are going to Saudi Arabia and places like that, too. But
understood. Understood.
So well, that brings up a palace theater.
Sure. A palace theater. That brings up the question of aspect ratios in general. I wanted to ask you about that. For a while now, we've been hearing about if you have different programs with different aspect ratios, and we know that we do. We have 4x3 or 1.33:1 standard def TV. We have 16x9 or 1.78:1 high def TV. And we have 1.85:1 and 2.35:1 movies. And for a while now, we've been talking about the best way to do that, to have different aspect ratios on a projection screen, is with side masking and to keep the height the same for all of them and just bring in these black velvet masking panels to cover the part of the screen that isn't being used for any given aspect ratio. But recently I heard of another approach, which is called constant area, which is to keep the total square footage the same and vary the width and the height to maintain a constant area image. What's your feeling on those two approaches?
Well, we address both of those approaches. One is with the Cine Curve, which is a constant height variable width. I kind of like that system because it's fairly simple. Then we have another system called Director's Choice, which does exactly what you're talking about, but it has variable side masking and variable top masking and variable bottom masking. Tony Grimaldi, which you're familiar with, likes a system called 2.0, and it will basically do all this through projector zooming and software programming. Mm-hmm. I think what's going to be interesting here is when TI comes out for home cinema with their scope chip, mm-hmm. and I think we're going to see the constant height variable width we'll see it more and more, and we're not going to need an anamorphic lens to do that. So
right.
I think,
and we're talking about Texas Instruments DLP chip, which will have a native pixel aspect ratio of 2:3:5:1. So it'll have, and I think we already saw a couple of projectors with that chip in it at Cedia, which it has 2,500 and some pixels horizontally, and I forget how many more than 1,080 vertically. So that gives you that scope, what we call the scope ratio, 2:3:5:1, without needing an anamorphic lens. In that case, will we then not need curved screens?
As far as the anamorphic lens, the problem with the pincushion, that should go away. But for all the other reasons that I mentioned, I think that would stay.
Yeah, understood. Well, listen, unfortunately, we're out of time, and I've got so much more to talk about. So will you come back on the show sometime?
Certainly.
Great. Fantastic. I want to thank Don Stewart, owner and partner at Stewart Film Screen, for being on the show today and having lots of informative things to say. You can check out Stewart Film Screen at where else? StewartFilmScreen.com. My online homes, of course, are UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. And you can email me at Scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at HTGeekScott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Jeremy Kipnis, a home theater consultant with the world's most expensive home theater. Wait till you see the pictures of this thing. It's amazing. So I sure hope you'll join me. And until then, as always, geek out.